here with your bonus content for the month. Man, am I really excited to present this one, because the first time I read it, I just could not put it down. It kind of comes from this fascination I've always had with biblical stories, ever since I was a wee lad. For sure, my first introduction to strange stories by strange authors for strange listeners was the Bible, particularly the stories where God literally talks to people. Like, not crazy people, not people smoking a little too much ayahuasca, just folks doing their little normal human things, and then woof, build an ark, kill your son, climb that mountain and write this shit down. The literal voice of a thing responsible for everything. Look, I don't care if you're a devout something or other or a total non-believer. This isn't about faith or skepticism. This is about, and God spoke to Moses, and the word of the Lord came to Jonah. To me, just as a lover of speculative fiction and speculative notions in general, that's a fascinating and mind-blowing thing to try and conceive of, and a hell of a premise of a story. Which is why it's always been nuts to me that that's never actually the premise of the story in all the stories where God audibly talks to humans in the Bible. It's always like, just the opener. Well, as we'll see with our story this week, Bring Them Down by Ben H. Winters, it makes for a pretty good story, too. This is actually going to be a two-parter, but I'm not going to make you wait long for the second part, because you'll be upset with me if I do. Trust me. Anyways, let's get into it, shall we? Read by Tina Connolly and Lex Wilson, we bring you Bring Them Down by Ben H. Winters.
Pete doesn't really feel sad at all. Last night, when she realized she was never going to see her parents again, she had felt sad. But just for a little while. Running away with Robert, slipping out the cracked window, leaving them behind, it was like she knew she was supposed to feel sad, so she did. But then she forgot she was supposed to, and she stopped. By now they had really done it, and she didn't feel anything. Running away didn't matter. If she had stayed, she'd be saying goodbye to them anyway. If she'd stayed, waited for morning and the feast, she'd be dead too. She'd never see them or anything ever again. Unless she believed what God said. Unless she believed what they said that God said, since she had never heard him herself. Unless she believed that they would be reunited on the other side. She had never really believed it, though. Never in her heart. And now she's free. She doesn't feel sad at all. The world is beautiful this morning, as she and Robert make their way from the fourth circle into the third, back toward Building 49. The scattered leaning trees that line the sidewalks and the windows of the buildings and the tattered awnings, it is more than beautiful. It is like everything is washed in beauty, varnished in it. There are specific small things that P knows she will miss, that she sort of misses already. Her friend Janet doesn't like pudding, and always saves hers for P. Has been doing so since they were tiny kids. She and her cousin Ruth invented a language one summer. They would whisper sing made-up words to each other during star night, when the whole city gathered out on the big lawn looking up at the distant planets. She and Ruth would lie with foreheads just barely touching, giggling secret silliness. Jenna is dead now, too. And Ruth, too. And her parents. But P doesn't feel sad at all. She climbs the narrow stairwell of Building 49, pausing now and then to let Robert catch up. He's a bit heavy, a bit out of shape. He huffs and puffs along behind her. Just the two of them. The thought sets loose a clamor of birds in her stomach. Just the two of them, of all the people in the world. On floor 16, P's floor, they walk down the hallway. Every apartment has a glass window that lets out onto the corridor. That's how they were built, more communal, more friendly. Now as they pass down the corridors, they see in each window a frozen picture of death. Families seated in semicircles around kitchen tables, slumped or staring, mouths open or closed, hands clutching hands, chins tilted at unnatural angles, drinks mostly finished or just started. On every table, the joint of poisoned meat, mostly eaten. a few stray slices still clinging to the remains. P knows all the people in all the windows, her neighbors, her schoolmates, her friends, arranged like dolls, frozen in place, suicides in the service of the Lord. Like dioramas, P thinks, like projects from school. She slows her pace long enough to let Robert catch up, and she places a reassuring hand on the sweaty small of his back. He grins at her nervously, and they keep walking, abreast now, down the center of the hallway. It's funny about Robert. At school she barely knew him, but now she feels this responsibility, this burden, to make sure he's okay. He seems so shaken, so pale. He is silent and his face is drawn. I don't blame you, she says to him suddenly and takes one of his hands. His eyes widen in surprise and she squeezes his hand. They have stopped now where the hallway bends. Around the corner will be P's apartment and P's own dead parents. You were right, she tells him. We did the right thing. Yeah, he says, and looks not at her but at the floor. I know. But he doesn't know. He doesn't believe her. She can tell. He must be blaming himself. He's wondering what they will do, how they will live, how the world will go. We will handle it together, thinks P, and is pleased with herself, pleased at the maturity and the correctness of such a thought. They will. They will handle everything together, for they will have no other choice. Come on, she says, and takes Robert by the hand, and they go around the corner. This scene is like all the others. P's mother and father are seated across from each other at the kitchen table, still and silent, eyes like the eyes of dolls. The third chair, P's chair, is empty. The plate of meat is at the center of the table, very little left on it. The poisonous meat. The electric slicer with its curved end lies by her father's still fingers. Does it still work? P wonders idly. Anything left in the battery, or is that dead now too? Only now, only looking into her mother's empty eyes, does P feel a pang of grief, a momentary wash of sadness. Were they waiting for her to come back? Or did they assume that she had been found out, that someone from the center had at the last minute discovered her family's secret, their daughter's deafness to the will of the Lord, and that she was therefore not permitted to go through? Her mother would have been devastated, surely, to think the whole world was going on to gladness and permanent harmony, the whole world except for P. Surely her mother would protest. Surely her mother, if she really believed they were going on to paradise, wouldn't go without her daughter. And yet here she is, her thin arms lolling at her sides as if weighted. Here she is. She ate. She died. P shakes her head tightly back and forth. Never mind, never mind. It's gonna be okay, she says again to Robert. One way or another, it's going to be okay. Grief is gone again. There's no time for it, no time. What comes to P now is a sudden sense of mission. It's as if a voice speaks in her head and tells her what to do. Bring them down. Bring them down. But it is only as if a voice is speaking to her. No voice is really speaking. She hears no whisper of God, no echo of his voice, even now. Even now her head is still and silent, and the voice that speaks clearly up from that stillness is her own, announcing calmly and with purpose what is to be done. She has spent her whole life waiting for God to give her instructions, and now she is not. She doesn't need to be commanded. She knows what to do. Let's get to work, Robert, she says. And he looks up, startled, from his trance-like contemplation of her dead father and mother. Get to work. He steps back from the table, trips on a chair leg, and almost falls. Doing what? We have to bring them down, says P calmly. We have to clear the bodies. He scratches the side of his head, squints at her through his glasses. It's like he can't hear. The bodies? She nods. We're going to bring them down to the outskirts. We'll start with these, but we need to do all of them. Get rid of them. It'll take time. We have to. Robert gapes back at her, and she turns away, back to her parents. P is suddenly impatient. This is it. This is right. This is absolutely what must be done. The world has to begin again. The bodies must be gotten rid of. They will draw animals, maggots. They will stink and spread disease. There will be many problems, but this is the first. It has to be dealt with right away. Okay, says Robert at last, slowly, uncertain. Sure. He pushes his glasses up on his nose and rolls up his sleeves. Together they go down to the basement of Building 49 and find a handcart. They wrestle the stiff bodies away from the table and bump them laboriously down the stairs, one by one, and tie them into a cart they find unsecured, parked on a sidewalk in the fourth circle. P says, "More." And back they go, back into the building, and take a pair of neighbors and then another, so that by the time they set off for the outskirts 4 hours later, with the cart secured haphazardly to two bicycles, they have 6 people on the cart. 6 bodies. A flat, rolling cart full of corpses. They grunt and moan and labor to pull the cart with the bicycles. Halfway there they hit a curb and 4 of the corpses topple out into the road. They load them back on. P gives orders, as gently as she can, and Robert obeys. The world would have to be made new. One difficult chore at a time. One corpse at a time. Last night they had been 2 scared, giddy children slipping out from under the doom of the world. But now they are the world. They are the future. There is no time to be sad.
Bring her to me, says the voice. Bring her to me. God's voice is an alarm bell in the night. God's voice is a rattle of bones in a box. God's voice is a grinding, rusted growl. Robert clutches his forehead and grits his teeth, and God says it again. Bring her to me. And then silence. Robert releases himself and exhales and keeps walking. He is trailing his friend P by a couple of paces, as he has been for most of the time they've been walking, all these hours of fitful, giddy wandering. Following their feet, going this way and then that, under the vast, star-littered late-night sky, through winding and crooked alleyways, up half-paced streets, along the empty sidewalks, and the broad avenues of the little city. It was very late, and then it was very early, and now, at last, it is becoming day. Pale yellow light seeps between the buildings. P turns and gives him a tired, bleary smile, and Robert finds a way to smile back. Through all of these hours, Robert has had it, over and over, the voice in his head, now soft, now loud, now an imploring whisper, now an accusatory shriek. God's voice on occasion grants him an interregnum of silence, a minute, 10 minutes, and then comes roaring back, louder and more insistent on each return. Bring her to me. Bring her to me. Bring her now. There is no ambiguity, no confusion. What God wants is for Robert to kill P. God wants her to go through like everyone else has by now gone through. Bring her to me, says God. Bring her now. Robert screws his eyes shut as tightly as he can, and then releases them slowly. He will not do it. He will not obey. And he cannot allow P to see what is happening. He will not. He steps up beside her, gestures for her to wait a moment, and goes first, emerging now from the alley into one of the wide streets. Apartment buildings tower on either side, Building 16 and Building 17. Robert and P stare up at them with astonishment. There are no lights snapping on inside the buildings, no busy day beginning, no morning bustle evident in silhouette through the shades, breakfasts being made, clothes selected. P turns to him suddenly. Her palm is clapped over her mouth, and she is blinking her big black eyes rapidly. Blinking back tears? No, she is thinking. Considering something. He can see it buzzing in her eyes, busy movements, rapid thoughts. She's so pretty. The thought stabs Robert, freezes him in place. She's so pretty. I think, she trails off, bites her lower lip. I was thinking, I would like to go back and see my parents. Your parents, says Robert. God's voice, a bullhorn blare, bring her to me. He ignores it, fights against it, talks softly to P. Are you sure that's what you want? P nods forcefully, her brow furrowed and her mouth set and solemn. She's got her thick black hair tied back in a ponytail. He thinks again, as he's been thinking since he barged into her bedroom last night with his crazy idea, thinks how lucky he is to be with her. Just the two of them, in the whole world. He's so lucky. She's already on the way, walking quickly down the street toward Building 49. Robert rushes to keep up, tripping a little on the stump of a broken hydrant. Everything went just as Robert had hoped. He had convinced himself over a period of months to defy God's instructions, and then, last night, he convinced P to defy them too. And it looks like everyone else in the city, which means everyone else in the world, accepted what God has been whispering or shouting the last 17 years, that this world had fallen into sin and had to be rebuilt. Everyone else followed God's dictums to the letter, bought the meat, and poisoned the meat, and ate the meat, and died. But not Robert and his new friend P, not lucky Robert, and the sweet girl he's always watched and loved from afar. Now it's him and P, stumbling, weary but glad, through the dead quiet streets of the city, washed in morning sunlight. He'd imagined it happening just this way. He'd dreamed of this scene. Except, bring her to me. Like the pounding of a fist on a length of pipe, bear her away. Like bullets being fired into a wall. Stop it, hisses Robert into the chamber of his own mind. Stop it, please. And then, after the briefest of silences, after no silence at all this time, God does answer, tauntingly, smirkingly, like a peacock flaunting his omniscience. God answers, I will not stop. I will not stop until you bring her to me. The voice is with him, dogging his steps like a wolf following the track, sometimes hidden, but never gone. P turns down into the fourth circle. They're almost there. Bring her to me. I will not. It is why I let you live. I decided to live. You didn't decide anything. I'm deciding right now to keep walking, to keep living. I will ignore you forever if I have to. I will learn to live with you like a handicap. I will bear you like blindness. I will live my life. It is not your life I am interested in.
One at a time, says P firmly, we send the bodies over. Any kind of, like, a ceremony or something? We open the doors and we send them over, says P. We bring them down. That is the ceremony. All of the elaborate fencing and gating between the world and the outskirts. It's all so much stage setting now, de-electrified. All the people who work at the power station are dead now. All the people whose job it is to patrol the wall. P pushes gently on one of the handles, and the great glass doors swing slowly open. They can smell it right away, the hot stink of the bubbling tar desert outside. Robert makes a face, covers his mouth with both hands. P feels it too, hot winds blowing in from out there, burning her nose. She stands with her jaw set, her eyes set firmly on the future. Ready? Robert looks scared. Ready? P says again, and he nods. They start with P's father, heaving him up out of the cart, gripping him under his arms and dragging him to the edge. They count to three, and let him go, and watch him roll, flopping madly end over end into the hot poison landscape of the outskirts. Okay, says P after a moment. Next. This will take months, says Robert, as they roll P's mother off the cart, her pale arms flopping under her. Then it takes months. P lets the body go and watches the slow, rolling tumble along the cliff's edge, watches as it lands with a soft, sickly hiss in the sulfur. Then she watches, mesmerized despite herself, as her mother's body dissolves into the bubbling dirt. It's just a body, she thinks. Just a thing. But then when we're done, then what will we do? P turns away from the grim sight of her mother's body, slowly dissolving, becoming mud and minerals. Whatever we have to. She is untying the next body from the cart. A neighbor, Mrs. Tyler, she babysat P many times when P was very young. P is thinking about all they will have to do. They will have to learn how to run the power station, how to automate it, perhaps. They will have to learn how to use the greenhouses, how to plant and harvest. She looks at Robert. He is reluctantly cutting loose another of the corpses from the cart. They will have to have sex to repopulate the species. P, at 13 years old, has no experience of sex. She has a concept of the anatomy, a basic understanding, but no tactile experience. She's never kissed a boy. Once she had a dream that was exciting and scary. But now, standing here at the edge of the livable world, before a cart full of death, nothing feels scary. Nothing feels overwhelming. They'll just do whatever comes next. Whatever has to come next, they'll do.
The world is just the city and the outskirts. That's all that it is. And the outskirts are not even that far away. They ride slowly because of the load. They stop frequently to catch their breath and rest their muscles, but it's only a few miles, 5 miles, 6 miles. From the heart of the city to the ring of stone walls and glass doors dividing it from the uninhabitable world beyond. Robert and P and their friends and their parents, they had always lived what felt like the ghost of a life, lived in a world that was like the memory of a world. It was their great-great-great-great-grandparents' generation who had arrived here. It was they who had made the world, who had scratched a city out of the 10 square miles of livable land on the arid volcanistic planet to which they had been consigned. They who had erected the buildings, paved the roads, built the greenhouses and the hydraulic systems and all the other pieces of infrastructure. That first generation, they did all the work. They put up the system of fencing and overlapping electric gates that separated the livable city from the impassable, impossible rest of the world. It was never supposed to be a permanent arrangement. The others were supposed to return once a better environment was located, a more suitable atmosphere. They were supposed to return to fetch the people from these rickety glass apartment buildings so they could rejoin the human race. They were at least supposed to have sent word, sent something. The years had gone by. Generations begat generations. Their tiny new civilization had scrabbled and scrambled along, clinging to their hope that soon enough word would come, the others would return. The next chapter would begin. It never happened. Anticipation shaded into anxiety, and then to fear and desperation. Until God began to speak. 2 dozen years ago, long before P and Robert were born, when their parents had themselves been children, God spoke first to one person, to Jennifer Miller in Building 14, blessed be her name, and then to another person, and then another. God's word was first ambiguous, and then it was specific. And as terrifying and strange as it was, it breathed new life into all of them. It reminded the people of this dead, distant world that they were people. God's voice, intimate and powerful, arrived offering not only a plan, but an explanation. Here is why this has happened. Here is what this small, tremulous existence of yours here means. Here is what comes next. Here is the date for the next phase of life. That phase is death. And now it has come to pass for all of the people of the world but 2. And here they are, standing with their handcart full of corpses, peering through one of the glass doors into the harrowing vista of the outskirts. Robert gazes with aching tenderness at this girl, this magical creature, standing beside him on the ragged edge of the world. He enjoys a long moment of astonishment at the strength she seems suddenly to possess, laboring these frozen, dead bodies, her own parents, off the cart, pushing them down over the side, doing what has to be done. And he knows that he loves her, that he was made to love her. And then the voice returns. Now. No. His stomach jerks inside of him. His head throbs with pain. Now. No, please. But there is nothing else to say or to do. If God can manifest in his mind, God can manifest in his body. And he manifests in his body now, yelling, now, again, even as he sets the child's body in motion. Robert had taken the electric slicer from P's apartment, from the table where P's parents had left it. Robert had not remembered taking it, but now, here it is. It's in his hand, and his boots crunch on the gravel and sand as he moves. Bring her to me.
Oh my God, what's gonna happen? Have faith, my children. All will be revealed soon. But seriously, give it a day or so. But for now, folks, that'll do her. So, hey, I appreciate your support of me and the show. I really do. And I just want you to know that I will bear its voice for as long as it takes and not do what it says. And if you want to go back and toss bodies all day, you just point me the way to your parents' house, and that's where we'll begin. Until then, see you soon.